interaction there. Good evening. For those of you who were not here this morning, I know you know Dr. Henschke and you know me, or something of me. Let me say some more words about Pastor Eggert again. Perhaps it is enough to say that he has worked for 13 years as the director, as the director of the pastoral care department of the DePaul Rehabilitation Hospital in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and there has served not only as chaplain in the sense of being a spiritual counselor and a doer of worship services, but as an educator, a one-to-one counselor, a group therapist, a family therapist, and now a person who works with adolescents, also doing, you know, group and healing kinds of things. So he comes with a lot of good credentials. He has a lot of experience and a lot of training, and he exhibited that this morning in his most competent and helpful presentation. The one thing I forgot to mention this morning is that he is a member of Missouri Synod's Committee on Alcoholism and Drug Dependency, and there are a couple of us who have had the privilege of doing workshops throughout the country for pastors and teachers. And so that's kind of one of the things that we look forward to doing and we've enjoyed doing. And he has been very fortunate to get some LWML money to perpetuate that after the grants from the Aid Association for Lutherans were no longer, the grant monies were no longer available. So what we've decided just now in your presence to do this evening is simply to respond to any questions or concerns that you have, or enable you to respond to one another in terms of questions and concerns. The topic is ministering to the alcoholic.
Mr. Eggert, this morning, I heard you sort of classify drinkers into three categories: social drinkers, drunkards, and alcoholics. Was that correct?
That's what I said.
They've asked us to repeat the question.
Oh.
Table. Go back some over.
Yeah, question was raised whether, in fact, I did say there were classifications of drinking population, the social drinker, the drunkard, and the alcoholic. Yes, I did say that.
Could you describe each of those categories or particular?
Well, okay, at least as I understand them. To me, a social drinker is anyone who at any time uses an alcoholic beverage strictly for sociability. If I go out this evening and enjoy a glass of wine for gemütlichkeit, sociability, that's social drinking. If I've played around the golf and it's warm out and I decide to have a beer at the 19th hole, to me that's social drinking. No particular problem with social drinking as far as I'm concerned. Drunkenness to me is something which is done deliberately, premeditatingly, generally with a given situation. For example, shibboleth parties where I grew up. Well, it would just assume that you're going to get drunk. The intoxicated, they call it drunkenness. New Year's Eve is a frequent time when people, almost before the evening starts, they just, well, tonight we're going to get drunk. We're going to get hammered, whatever expression you use. It's not an ongoing situation, but because of the situation, oh, tonight we get drunk. It's drunkenness. It's premeditated. It's deliberate. It's not an ongoing kind of thing. It doesn't happen repeatedly. And the jelly, the major consequences of the headache you have the next morning. And then there's alcoholism, the thing which I described this morning, where the loss of control. I don't think anyone drinks with the intent of becoming alcoholic. But I think we drink at times to get drunk, and there are times when we drink socially. Okay? Well, there's nothing cast in bronze on that. This is the way I perceive drinking.
Yeah, I don't know. Go ahead.
If I'll point at you, now I'm trying to be rude.
A few years ago, a think tank out east came up with did a study on alcoholism, and one of their conclusions was that some people who have been alcoholics can recover, and in time after treatment, return to social drinking. Do you think that that's a possibility, or do you categorically reject
I pretty much categorically reject. Oh.
Okay, the question. Can you understand one another here? Maybe I don't have to repeat it.
It's not for them. It's for the tape.
We're taping this
yes,
again?
We're taping
Well, I better be careful then.
Not really. You weren't careful this morning. Don't start now.
The question was raised whether I felt that some comments that were made in East a number of years ago, in fact, it came out of Boston University, Boston Hospital, Boston General. Incidentally, the man who pronounced that at that time died of alcoholism after that. The groups that I've tried probably the hardest to promote controlled drinking has been the VA system, the VA hospitals. I don't know of any of them that are still doing it. Then they try what they call aversion therapy. I don't know of any VA hospitals that are using aversion therapy anymore, because it just wasn't successful. I personally feel very strongly that there's no such thing as social or controlled drinking once you become addicted. Now, the theory at that time was, if through, for example, psychoanalysis, I can get at the basis, the cause, so to speak, of the drinking, then surely you ought to be able to drink again. Well, that may take care of a psychological dependence, but I don't think it touches a physiological dependency. And to me, that's the thing they overlooked.
Right.
Someone also, I had a question. Okay, go ahead.
You mentioned this morning about family intervention therapy, and I got talking about that with somebody else, and they raised the point that would seem like it would be very dangerous to really come in and confront someone.
Can you help me to understand? What do you mean? What? Where do you see the danger? What do you feel would be dangerous about it?
Well,
or danger to whom?
This person was thinking that these people would tend to be very defensive, which you did mention, but that they would also maybe, you know, be the kind of people that would try to get people on their side, maybe in your congregation, try to work the people in the board of elders against you, and it could be a really touch and go situation, maybe even in terms of your job.
No, I don't think that would happen, because the individual who has been in a family confrontation, a crisis situation, isn't very apt to go and announce this to very many people in the parish, because this, in a sense, would be admitting that there are 4, 5, 10, whatever people already think I'm an alcoholic, and I really question whether he would ever do that. And as far as my position being in jeopardy, again, it's not my accusative statement, it's the accusative statements of his own family. So I'm not feeling threatened by this.
I'd like to make a comment, though, in regard to that. My position may be a bit different, I don't know. In terms of our function as a parish pastor, I don't see that normally we would carry out that confrontation or be the facilitator or coordinator of that. We might encourage it. We might recommend it, we might support it, we might participate in it as the pastor in Chaplain Eggert's example or case study this morning. But I would suggest that probably most of the time we would want someone associated with a treatment center, a therapist, to do that, a person who is able to cover all of the bases that Chaplain Eggert spoke of in terms of the preparation counseling, the preparation meetings, getting things all arranged at the hospital. So I haven't checked this out with Chaplain Eggert to see whether he would kind of agree, but I didn't see that as being a function that we might do as parish pastors, ordinarily at least, but that it's something we know about and we would value, and we would see it as a way that to go, something available to us in terms of our working with folks.
I would tend to underscore that, in as much as the pastor and his role in the parish is largely representing a theology, and the theology would find some problems in terms of direct intervention in a family situation under those conditions, other than to refer them to agencies and to individuals who could be helpful to them immediately. So I would tend to underscore what Professor Knippel just stated.
In this particular situation that I was telling about this morning, where the pastor was involved, originally the parishioner was very angry with the pastor. And I had talked to the pastor prior to that, and he made it a point to come to the hospital to see Art. And they've developed a very close relationship now. There's really a pastor-Prishner relationship, because the Prishner now understands that what the pastor was doing was really to his benefit. And it maybe took that additional information you got into the sacramental line, and I happened to catch you at it, which is certainly no longer social drinking. So.
Mm. Carl has a question.
Right. Just a reference to who you saw, Dr. Minsky, you mentioned that Pastor represents the theology. How does that theology conflict with the direct confrontation in the family intervention?
How does the theology conflict with the direct intervention? I don't think it conflicts. I think you're looking for facilitation, for awareness in the patient. And as long as he's blocked out from that self-awareness, the pastor, and you know, we distinguish between pastoral care and pastoral counseling. Not only is a contract in pastoral counseling intimacy is not available to him immediately unless this person becomes aware of his imminent danger, but pastoral care becomes even problematic at that point, because it's a declaration of law gospel to a man who is not hearing. And as necessary as pastoral care and pastoral counseling are in this situation, first a relationship must be established, and I don't mean to imply that the Holy Spirit can't reach this man, but the pastoral role is so tied up with theological concepts, this man needs an awareness of his problem, of the tragic consequences of his behavior. And that must be a prelude to actual intervention on the part of a pastor, preparing for either pastoral care relationship or a pastoral counseling relationship.
Okay, then, so that if I understand this correctly, I understand the distinction you're making, if I understand the result, then I couldn't, as a pastor to this person, go through the same steps that Catherine Edgar did. And if she came to me, and let's say, well, obviously I couldn't read the outline she gave me, let's say I had studied it on my own, or taking a few courses on alcoholics at a university. Mm-hmm. Would it be within my, if I felt, which I understand to be subjective, if I felt capable enough, would it be within the pastoral role to go through the preparatory counseling, organize the family, and try and pierce through the denial screen myself? Or is it really necessary to have somebody completely outside, such as yourself?
I don't think it's absolutely necessary. You may be in a situation, for example, where you don't have a resource like that available to you. You may be in some North Wisconsin community, for example, there's nothing there, right? Or Western Nebraska, you know, out there. There weren't many agencies out there. And you may have to do it. But I think, again, it depends on what kind of groundwork you lay and how you set the situation up when you confront your parishioner. That you help him to understand immediately this is not something which you're doing vindictively or judgmentally. This is for his benefit, and because of your sincere concern for him, you feel this is for the ultimate good of him and his family. But always keep in mind you're there for his support and reassurance, so you don't lose him in the process. I think it's more delicate, but you know, sometimes that's all you have. And you may have to do it.
Art, did you have a question before?
Yeah, I'll address you, Dr. Hanschke. During the stage of, well, we're pulling the crutches out from under, say, the spouse, we're pulling the crutches out from under the alcoholic. It seems like to me in that phase of it, you're going to be encountering a lot of separation and divorce. What are the warnings that we can give during those periods of time? Warnings, cautions, whatever.
Well, needless to say, every case is quite individual. What are the warnings? What are the cautions that we can proclaim, either in a pastoral care role or a pastoral counseling role, dependent upon their willingness to enter into a contract with you or simply to hear the word with all its power?
I think the pastor gets caught from the rock and the hard place, and he's saying, you know, you've got to do all you can to alienate yourself from your spouse. And, you know, things go sour, and they come back on you and say, Pastor, what have you done?
Well, it wasn't my privilege to be here this morning, but I assume that what Chaplain Eggert was talking about was not a complete separation or alienation, but simply a refusal to run alibis for the person, let them live with the responsibility of their own behavior, not be protective, not confuse the needs of the alcoholic with the personal needs of the wife and the children. see, that these must be kept assiduously apart. And so the pastoral role in this would not be alienation and removal and separation, but rather, don't alibi for him. Let him live with the results of his drinking. Don't call the boss in the morning and say he's ill and cover up for him, see?
Tough love.
Tough love is what we're talking about, yes. And that would be the pastor's facilitating role to assist the family in carrying this out, see? And also try to interpret to the alcoholic that this is being done for his ultimate good, as Chaplain Eggers just remarked.
There are some situations where I recommend separation. And I'll be honest to tell you, there are some situations where I recommend a divorce. But I also emphasize that the motivation for the separation or the divorce must be love. And the first time they hear me say that, they think, well, now you're really kooky and off the wall. How can you divorce out of a motivation for love? Because if you don't, more often than not, it'll be out of motivation of anger and vindictiveness because of a particular situation, and then out of that impulse of anger, they'll run and see the attorney. 9 out of 10 will withdraw that divorce, and they'll rescue him again. So we don't talk about separation and divorce in first session. You know, we've tried literally everything else prior to this, and it's like the, I used the expression this morning, the straw to break the camel's back. If everything else has failed and you feel that you just cannot live in this situation, if his destructiveness, which becomes your destructiveness or the children, then issue him that final ultimatum. You know, either move out, take your booze, and in a sense go home, go someplace else. If they are willing then, if they go through the divorce process to take him back, once there's an indication of rehabilitation, and as I mentioned this morning, I've had 7 or 8 couples that I've remarried after they've been through treatment. But it's important how you emphasize what's the motivation for the separation. The motivation is to hopefully bring him to the reality of his illness. You tried every other conceivable avenue. It hasn't worked. We try this last one.
Sort of shock treatment.
You bet. And as I said this morning, we see quite a few people come in right after they got in the, received the blue envelope. Because even though they've said in the past,
hey, go ahead and leave. I'm glad you're going. It'll save me the problem. But when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, the one thing they don't want to lose is the emotional support of that family.
Of course, this problem, if I may intervene here for a moment, this problem is a delicate one for a pastor in his parish role to ever advocate divorce actively. And it would have to be after a long and protracted attempt on the part of all involved to practice Christian love and the intervention of the Holy Spirit to alter this person's behavior. If, however, these all fail, then I think I would go along with Chaplain Eggert. However, I don't think I would be too active in encouraging divorce at that point. I think that's appropriate for a treatment center or a chaplain, but a pastor has to live with these kinds of precedents, and the pastor advocated divorce. Wow, it's a delicate thing. As I say, yeah, these are individual cases.
Dan? Yeah. In fact,
part of the intervention process that the Johnson Institute uses, for example, let's say we've got this whole thing set up and he's adamant he will not go in. Or, as frequently happens, okay, I'll give up. Give me one more chance. See? Okay, then we contract with him. Put it in writing that you're not going to drink anymore. And in the event that you do, then you will accept our recommendation of treatment. And we get it in writing and have him sign it. Yeah. I forgot to mention that part.
That's his contract. That's good.
Mm-hmm. I had a question while we were speaking on marriage and divorce.
Mm-hmm.
How does alcoholism rank in terms of people who come in for pastoral counseling?
In divorce situations?
Well, just in terms of like a wife coming in saying, I've got a problem with my husband, the problem is, how does alcoholism rank? One or
Yeah, I think the Social Service Department up there, and I'm not real sure, that it's right at 70% of the divorce cases that come in are alcohol-related, or an alcohol basis to it.
LSS.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like
right
to
at 70%.
Say something to that out of my experience as parish pastor. I went from a full-time ministry in alcoholism and drug dependency back to the parish. And strangely enough, whether it was because I was trying to keep a low profile and didn't want people to think that all I could talk about was alcohol and alcohol problems or whatever happened, maybe I even got into a bit of the denial syndrome that were with, you know, related to people that were important to me. But oftentimes was not as sensitive to the possibility of there being an alcohol-related problem within their concerns. And, you know, a wife would come and talk about many things that were going wrong in the marriage or in the family or in the home. And it might be quite a while in that conversation before there was some hint of some inappropriate drinking or alcohol problem. And there were even times when I noticed I had to hear that two or three times, you know, like hitting me over the head before I responded to it. And as time went on, that struck me strange, you know, that that was happening to me. And I became deliberately much more more sensitive to that kind of talk. And indeed, if I didn't hear it, often asked questions about drinking behavior in the family. So I guess what I'm saying is many times it was really kind of heart and center, but it took a while for it to come out, and I think it's important for us to be sensitive and perhaps even to do some caring probing about that, as well as to keep our ears attuned. You know, so I learned something about myself and enhanced, I trust, my own pastoral care relationships. There's another dimension involved here in involving also drinking. And that is wife abuse, child abuse, violence in the home. And these are many times directly related to excessive drinking on the part of one or more of the family members. And I think we as pastors must be very sensitive also to that possibility. And this is, of course, one of the most difficult things for any family to report about itself. And so sensitivity, which Professor Knipple just suggested, has to be finely honed, must be very much on the alert, that your sensitivities to all these possibilities, as people sort of beat around the bush and don't really want to tell you what it's all about, these are all drinking related in many cases. And maybe sometimes they aren't really sure what it's all about either. As part of the denial, they see it as peripheral rather than central.
One other problem that we've become aware of since we have our adolescent unit is the high incidence of incest. Mm-hmm. Related to alcoholism between father and daughter.
Steve, I don't know who's first.
Go ahead.
So
maybe Steve
could get
in. You mentioned the high rate of alcoholism among pastors. What would you suggest as a good procedure for us to follow in trying to help a brother pastor having alcoholism? I personally feel, this is a personal opinion, if you even suspect
that a fellow student or a fellow pastor might be in the very early phases or even suggest excessive use of alcohol, I would very directly, lovingly confront him today. I would not procrastinate. I have changed my attitude about that considerably in the last 10 years. I've had some very happy experiences by that, not even with pastors, but with lay people that I knew. And there were some of the signs there. I thought, well, this doesn't seem quite cricket. And I would say, hey, I'm really concerned about you. I want to ask you something very personal. If you feel it's none of my business, forget about it. If there's any indication that there might be some honesty to it, then I'm willing to be some help. And it's been interesting how many of them would say, how did you know? Gee, I'm glad I can finally talk to somebody about it. So I do not procrastinate. If I feel any more than I saw Charlie limping real bad, I'd be concerned about his limp. See? And I wouldn't feel embarrassed about putting it off at all. But alcoholism to me is such a serious, devastating, destructive problem that I would rather err on the side that there is no problem rather than to let it go on unnoticed.
I think that's a very wise piece of advice, particularly in a community like ours here. the stress factors are already in evidence, and they're going to increase with entry into the ministry. And when we notice that stress factors are being converted into escape mechanisms, and the continued denial that it's a problem in their life is becoming very obvious to you as brothers and sisters in this community, I think a peer-to-peer confrontation is perhaps much more powerful than administration confrontation or professorial confrontation. So I don't want to lay a lot of guilt on you gentlemen and ladies present, but I think that our community must become much more sensitive to the need for this confrontation in love. Obviously, we don't need any witch hunting here, but...
That's partly related right there is that I can think on Vickers on a few occasions, you know, social parties where it's such a feelings orientation that a person has crossed the line maybe just a few times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if I'm reading gentlemen correct, that's the time to pull them off to the side of that first clue. And the same thing, my question was,
yeah,
how do you break through earlier? You know, and apparently that's the time. This isn't the time to organize the family and all that stuff. So,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you are your brother's keeper. You know, you ought to be concerned about it. And demonstrate that concern.
And the support, I mean, you said before, that just bringing him, I've been looking through quite a few marriage and family therapy catalogs, and it's odd to me that all of those catalogs contain at least a few drug dependency and alcohol dependency cartridges. And now,
so Jeff mentioned that if there are no drugs similar to Nicoban or something that are used with alcohol, Nicoban being, if you're not familiar, the pills that are taken which supposedly make a smoker sick every time you...
Antabuse.
Yeah. Well, the only one, Antabuse, which is an aversion drug that you will become very ill. If you have antabuse still in your system and you drink within, depending on how much antabuse you take, and if you drink within 72 hours, you will have an allergic effect to it, and you can become very ill.
Is that often used?
Yeah, many treatment programs use it.
Behavior mod. Ipecac,
yes,
was used by the Marines to with drug addiction, particularly heroin addiction. And Ipecac is even more radical than antabuse in terms of its retching effects. These people want to die.
Yeah. It's nothing to be trifled with.
David?
Okay. You've gotten the person into treatment from the three of you. How do you then function with him in terms of pastoral care? What are things you have found useful and effective?
Do you want us to answer in roll? If you don't mind, Chaplain,
right,
I'll answer first. I think the responsibility of the pastor, since he cannot provide the intensive therapy nor the possible group therapy that's indicated, should get him to a treatment center as quickly as possible, preparing the family, first of all, for support situations. And I'm speaking purely off my cuff because I wasn't privileged to hear Chaplain Eggert this morning. I've heard him on other occasions, but today I missed him. And so my first reaction would be, since I cannot provide the intensive therapy and the amount of time that's involved in drawing up a contract, even though I'm trained for this, nevertheless, my first duty is to alert the family and to alert the individual as to the seriousness of the problem. They're ready for treatment, and I should take them to the nearest treatment center.
But they're in treatment already. That
okay.
was the
okay.
direction. They're in treatment.
Then I would...
What do you do in terms of pastoral care? What do you do to complement what's being done in with treatment?
So they're in treatment, and what is my function then as his pastor?
Yes.
While he's in treatment, perhaps institutionalized for the drying out period, My function then is to bring him the Word of God and comfort him in terms of any strong guilt feelings, which he no doubt will harbor very very severely within himself, the damage that has been the result of his excessive drinking to his family, to everyone, and to himself. And so you will bring to this person, and because he is already in treatment, we will assume that he is repentant for the sins involved, carrying a great deal of guilt. My function would be to bring him the assurance of forgiveness, interact with the therapist involved, and I would be very pleased if Chaplain Eggert was among the team, and I would compare notes with him in terms of our ministry together. I would not be a therapist under those conditions. I would be a supportive pastor, and I would try to get as much information in terms of the treatment that's used, in terms of what is appropriate at every stage of the game, and continue supplying pastoral care.
Okay, so you found working in terms of a confession absolution.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. To be effective. Pastor, when you have dealt with people as a champ, mm-hmm. what do you find useful with pastoral care?
Okay, the way we operate there, each one of us are assigned to a specific group of counselors. Let's say an adolescent is admitted. First thing is, on what we refer to as our initial interview, we attempt to make a spiritual assessment. We become acquainted with them. We let them know who we are, where we are, where they can get in touch with us, that try to find out a little bit about what their own spiritual background or religious interest might be, or background. Let them know that what the chapel service program is, the Bible class program, things like that. I generally also attempt to point out what my direct contact will be with them and when it will be. For example, second week of treatment I begin to have class with them. I don't have any class with them the first week of treatment. Second week of treatment I begin to have class with them on what we call the spiritual aspect of the program, steps 2 and 3. Maybe Charlie can help you. I think if you just contact the Council on Alcoholism here or one of the aid groups, they may give you a little card like that. We refer to it as a billfold card. Has the 12 steps and 12 traditions and a Serenity Prayer on it. And I generally give them one of them with my card. I said, well, you're probably not acquainted with this, but I'll be getting with you with steps 2 and 3 in your second week of treatment. I know whether you're here this morning, maybe you don't remember all the steps. The second step says, I became willing to admit that a power greater than myself has to restore me to sanity. See? So the one thing that the alcoholic struggles with is this, what I refer to the big eye, the self-centered, egotistical eye, that I don't need anybody, I'm going to do it myself. And we have to begin to help them to get out of the driver's seat, and the willingness to begin to recognize that something other than themselves is going to have to help them transfer this dependency. And that's where step 3 comes in. We turn our lives and our wills over to the care of God. Now, what do we mean by that? How do you go about that? And one of the things which, again, is one of the stumbling blocks to that is the thing which Dr. Henschke talks about is, we call it garbage. He called it guilt. The garbage of past behavior. Get that monkey off your back. How can you go through that process? Well, you make an inventory, pros and cons. Same like a checking account. You got liability, you have assets. And we begin to pick up their sense of self-respect and their self-confidence. The fifth step is a follow-up to that, which is the kind of the confessional step, if you will. I admit it to myself, God as I understand him, and another human being, the exact nature of my wrong. And they go through the detail in our particular guide to the fourth step, we call the guilt of past behaviors. And they begin to enumerate this in a very detailed fashion. And that's particularly where I come in with this whole thing of self-absolution. That they again begin to feel forgiven by God. And then you've got all the beautiful passages in Scripture about God's forgiveness, whether it's in the Psalms or in 1 John or in Hebrews, you know. The New Testament is loaded with statements of total forgiveness. Particularly with some of the gals who have a lot of struggle, who've been involved in infidelity, know some of the most loving, most compassionate demonstrations of Jesus Christ are in relationship to the adulterous female, right? And I say, hey, I would like to refer this to you. And everybody gets a Bible. And I said, hey, read this. This is where it is. Take a look at it. Some of them still have some real struggles with it. I set up an appointment for another one-to-one. I see every patient that's assigned to me a minimum of 5 direct conferences with them, plus the classwork. And so we get at a lot of the struggles they're having about themselves, their relationship to God. What does the gospel of Christ really mean to them? And of course, in our chapel services, we put a lot of emphasis on gospel-oriented, direct relationship, how they fit into this gospel situation. They have to really begin to feel that our message is to them, not generalities. And to show you how much this happened, well, this happened a few years ago. There was a visitor at the chapel one morning. A friend of hers was at the chapel, and I was talking about the alcoholic. And I talked about them as being the alcoholic. And after the service, she came to me, she says, "I was really disappointed with your sermon this morning." "Well, which preacher wants to hear that?" And I said, "Would you like to tell me what about you?" She said, "You know, these people know they're alcoholics, and they hear about alcoholism every day, and you talk about it on Sunday." And I said, "Yeah, and I'll continue to do that. If that's your only complaint, I'll accept that, but I'll continue to do it. The name of the game is alcoholism in that institution, and chemical dependence. And they'd better begin to understand that their chemical dependence, which is the cause of separation from Almighty God, and it's only the gospel that's going to reestablish that relationship." So I don't apologize for that at all. No, a lot of them keep coming back there. That's kind of, they've kind of adapted that as their church home since they've been discharged. They don't want to get into the church and the community. They keep coming back there. And I have excellent attendance from people who have been discharged 6, 7, 8 years ago are still coming back there Sunday after Sunday.
Do you feel uncomfortable?
Uncomfortable? Why should I feel uncomfortable?
Well, think that it is a treatment center, and that they're coming back, and somehow there has not been any, at least at that point, reintegration in the life of a parish.
Is that important?
Well,
they're involved in corporate worship right there at the chapel. This is their church home now. I think it's their supportive system that they keep coming back to, and I'm certainly not going to discourage it.
I'll come at it as a parish pastor. Dan, I've got a turn yet, okay?
All right. Yeah, we're not trying to cut you off.
No, I see you. I think I would perceive myself in two roles, although they are not separate from each other functionally. One would be kind of a coordinator or an overseer of some team activity, and the other is being an important member of the team. Some random thoughts that have to do with that. By coordinator, I mean kind of looking at the whole continuum of care that the person's receiving and spotting any weaknesses in that or any loopholes in that and wanting to do something about that to be sure that the person is receiving the right kind of care physically, psychologically, emotionally, socially, financially, whatever. The other thing I would want to do is to do my own ministry as a minister of word and sacrament. I would want to be supportive. I'd want to be listening. I would want to be telling or proclaiming, as Dr. Henschke said. I think I would very much want a person into AA ongoingly, so I would see one of my jobs as continually Christianizing the AA program, or helping the person to Christianize, to baptize the AA program, to keep the theology straight, to move from God as we understand him to God who is our Father in Jesus Christ. I think if the fourth and fifth step work didn't happen in the treatment center, I would want to encourage that. And if I could be helpful in the fourth and fifth step work, I would make myself available to that, for that. As time went on, I think I could look in on the family and see if there were some problems that were arising in recovery, because oftentimes problems come out of recovery. Roles and relationships change, and sometimes people don't like that. Especially a wife who's kind of been in charge of the family all of a sudden has a husband who's ready to take charge again, and she's not quite sure how she feels about that and probably needs someone to help her work that through. Or maybe I will be the one that's sensitive to discover that there are some unsolved underlying problems if that's not found in treatment
or by an ongoing relationship with a treatment center or program, and that I might be able to be helpful there in discovering that and recommending some kind of care as well as providing some care. Maybe even at that point myself getting into some pastoral counseling with that person if I feel that's appropriate. So those are some of the random things that I think that I would at least think about doing.
By the time we see the people at our treatment center, very, very few of them are still in an ongoing worshiping relationship in any church. Very few. And the few that are, and you ought to be aware of a federal regulation. Let's say, for example, you were admitted to DePaul. And I'd say, well, who's your pastor? Do you have a church? Well, yeah, I'm from Ascension. Pastor Henske's my pastor. I, without your written consent, would not be permitted to contact your pastor by law. See? Because of the confidentiality of the chemical dependent. Now, let's say you give me the consent. It's at least 50-50 where if I contact the pastor, they won't come to see their parishioner. It's at least 50%.
So I hope you fellows, when you get a call from somebody to come see your parishioner, do it. So that at that point, they need your support. And what a beautiful opportunity you have to reestablish a relationship with a person who has probably drifted away from the church by the time he's come into treatment.
I think Dan was struggling to get in again.
Yeah, my question is on a little bit different line here.
Okay.
It seems to me that a 13-year-old girl and a 45-year-old father or husband would react in a different way to the family intervention. I think how do you modify the structure that you outlined this afternoon for adolescents?
Well, you don't need that. You don't need that with the adolescent, particularly if the adolescent is still at home. If, as a minor, the parents have the right to say, you will go to the hospital.
Yeah,
the parents do the confronting. We get probably as many, at least at our treatment center, and I'm sure this varies from place to place, we probably get as many court referral adolescents as we do home referrals.
Responding to the former question in terms of the pastor's role, remember there's an ethical fine line that needs to be drawn here. The chaplain has assumed responsibility in terms of providing spiritual support for this patient in an institution separated from the usual support system. He has assumed that. That's why it's very necessary that the resident pastor, if he still has a church home, be, first of all, informed, secondly, respond to it, but then make every effort to get in touch with the chaplain and coordinate the spiritual support system that's going to be provided. He shouldn't be duplicating what the chaplain is already doing. So the chaplain has an enviable position in terms of staffing privileges, in terms of insights that are provided through staffing, which the pastor does not have. So the pastor should really defer quite a bit to the chaplain for the moment. And when the time is ripe and the healing has taken place, and there comes a time when he's about to be restored to family and church, then the pastor, after regular visitation and devotional prayer offerings for this patient, will be ready to receive him back and integrate him again into the church family. This has to be very delicately done, and the transfer from chaplain back to pastor must take place. The pastor must be present and responsive, but should not be duplicating what the chaplain is attempting to do as part of the therapy, which is involving staffing and insights from other areas which are not available to a pastor. Am I right with that, Chaplain Nager? Okay, but maybe the one thing, I'm not sure that every treatment center has a chaplain that does
no
the kind of thing
right.
that Ed does, and we need to be aware of that too. Not every treatment center has an Ed Eggert. Maybe a chaplain.
My basic assumption was that I found him there.
Yeah. And I quite agree. I just wanted to say that you don't always have a guy doing the kind of job, and
no.
It's even more important for us to be involved in when we have the opportunity.
Right. There was one back there that I know. Go ahead. Well, I'm going to assume you weren't here this morning.
Either, if you were, I didn't communicate very well. Well, okay, that's one instrument you can use. It's called the Michigan Alcoholism Scale. But I think the other things, you know, I was trying to identify the loss of control, the black arts, the hiding the bottles, the defensiveness, the breakdown in communication, the beginning to lie about the situation, particularly to the wife, they become pathological liars. The preoccupation with alcohol, all of these things are the symptoms that you need to be aware of. But you say, well, how can you tell when he's, if I understood you, when is he alcoholic? Well, when he loses the ability to control how much he drinks or when he drinks.
May I intervene and tell you that there's no limit on the, there are no limits on the donuts back there, so if you feel like getting up, help yourself.
Lose control. Yeah, lose control. There you go. Yes.
Yes, you said that sometimes when people intervene and confront alcoholics with the fact that they're alcoholics, sometimes they ask for a second chance, you know, I'll stop drinking myself. How often does that happen? Is an alcoholic able to, without any kind of rehabilitation or treatment, able to stop themselves, you know, from drinking anymore?
They frequently will temporarily. Yeah, like for a while, they do it just on their own muster. They're just determined they're going to prove this family wrong, and they do it for a while. That's not uncommon. But the thing which does not happen is nothing happens with insight. Nothing changes psychologically or attitudinally. Only it's, we use a kind of an interesting statement, if you got a drunken horse thief and you take his booze away, you still got a horse thief. Right? And if you, and we differentiate between dry and being sober. Dry simply means that you're not drinking, but nothing has happened insight-wise. Sobriety means that you made the surrender and you're happy not needing the alcohol anymore. Okay. Only for a short period of time. Yeah. Now, I'm sure somebody's going to say, well, I know so-and-so. I know of one situation that happened when I was in Minneapolis because of a very traumatic experience. The man ran over a girl as she was crossing the street and killed her while under the influence of alcohol. The man hasn't taken a drink since. See? But I wouldn't want to wait for something like that to happen. See? And I'm sure there are other situations where someone quit like that. Someone made the suggestion today that someone might have, by the power of the Spirit, a conversion experience and quit. I'm certainly not going to say that can't happen, because I've seen the Spirit do some strange and marvelous things. But I think those are the exception. See? I would not wait for that to happen.
I think you have a gentleman.
I think you said a little bit this morning, and Ronnie mentioned you didn't want to deal with alcohol tonight, but with that lesson, is there a higher dependence on marijuana? And what type of treatment?
At our institution, at least, we see almost an equal amount of alcohol and pot, or marijuana, used coordinatingly, so to speak. They're poly abusers. If you've had any experience with pot, you know, if you've smoked your second or third joint of the day, you're going to get a cotton mouth, right? You get so dry you can't hardly spit. And the one thing which will wash it out is beer. And they learn that very quickly. Just like, you know, pot smokers get the munchies. And so we see very rare that we have a pot smoker or a marijuana dependent who is not also alcohol dependent. And it's almost impossible to say, are there more pot smokers than alcoholics or more alcoholics than pot smokers? We don't see enough variance to say, and so we hardly ever talk about alcoholism or drug dependence, we call it chemical dependence now. But there's so many other chemicals along with it. You know, acid is one of the very common ones. For about 2 years ago, angel dust was very popular. It's kind of dissipated now. Right now, coke is a hot thing.
Cocaine, that's, of course, very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
So often, in if you were to take the cycle, that the alcoholic is cryptic, very hidden, hiding a bottle. family wants to bury it, and then they go through treatment, and the only case I know of was a boy, she wanted to publicize it. I'm an alcoholic, very out in the open. In fact, I was a little bit taken back, you know, like, my question is, what is the pastor's response to the recovery alcoholic, as you call it? Is it the, obviously not the Mormon Mr. Alcoholic, but I mean, to be that open, to be that reminder like you are in those sermons, and so often it relates to a small parish, especially the ones the candidates get, and it's, you're out there, you know, you're out there and everybody knows that Joe, you know, coming back from the treatment center, are we to maintain this upfront? Sure, he's an alcoholic, don't worry about it, ask him, or what is that? That we're supposed to carry on to recover the alcoholic.
I'm not sure I understand your question. Are you saying, what is your attitude toward the individual who comes back and says, hey, I'm an alcoholic?
No, the one who's a recovered.
Yeah.
What is your attitude toward that person? How should you behave toward them? Any different?
No different than I would toward any other human being. The alcoholic is no different than you or I, other than that he doesn't drink. I think one of the things you can do is help him to become integrated into the parish again, because I'm sure there's a fair number of people in the parish who have some real concern about this guy. You know, how should we act about him? They feel almost uncomfortable around him. Next time we invite him over for a party, they're almost uncomfortable. Gee, should we hide all the booze, or can we offer him a booze? And I said, well, why don't you ask him? How does he feel about it? If he feels comfortable with the rest of you, have a beer, okay, then go ahead and have a beer, if that's what you're planning to do anyway. But if you're going to have something, be sure you give him an alternative. Give him some options. Have some beer or wine or tea, not wine, some coffee, milk or tea or some soda, something like that. See?
I think what Carl is getting at here is perhaps the person who comes back and has been hungry for recognition, and this is a new way of acquiring recognition from the entire congregation, and he becomes almost exhibitionistic about it. I think that's perhaps what Carl was getting at.
Yeah, in the case that I've done, I mean, you're almost laid back. AA meetings, they're all, I'm an alcoholic, you know. They say that, and they have to say it very soundly. Do you play that up? Do you, that's along that line. I'm having trouble phrasing it, because I'm not quite sure what I am.
That's a new experience for me. I haven't had many alcoholics that came into the community and were that outgoing about it. But the other thing, you know, part of their program is anonymity. And I think you should give them the opportunity to identify themselves as a recovering alcoholic. I don't think you should put it in the bulletin.
But what if they ask you to?
Well,
that's what he's talking about.
Yeah. That's new. I've never had anyone quite that... as you say, exhibitionistic about it, because generally they're very low-key about that.
Other
than when at an AA meeting, sure, they all say, my name's Ed, I'm an alcoholic, you know, no problem.
Has this been an experience of yours, Carl?
Yeah, and it was a neighbor who happened to be a member of the church in Chicago. Boy, I'm an alcoholic, you know, she took a job as going around to the factories in the neighborhood, giving lectures.
Yeah, that's on you.
You had much.
I don't see where you're happening.
I think the lady over here has a question. I've never had that experience where someone was that open and, you know, at a worship program, for example.
It's possible that there was another pathology involved, like Ed pointed out before, a horse thief, a drunken horse thief is still a horse thief when he's recovered. So this person may have some pathological need for recognition, which evidenced itself in this way. Normally, people want to keep this anonymous and quiet.
Good.
I was just on a website and stuck in a town that has a college or university. And let's say there's, hi, excuse me, it's
That's a good one.
Okay, let's say, back in college, like you were saying, there's a number of things, marijuana, alcohol, these different things that tend to multiply that effect. Like let's see, you said 6 to 8 years for a man that's an alcoholic, whatever. In college, it happens far more rapid. It could happen 2 to 3 years. I'm wondering what type of program can we offer or give the kids in our parishes that will help them? Where can we go to receive instruction? Like maybe the CP program, if there's one in the area, I was thinking, but I was wondering, what other programs, are there any booklets or anything that could help us in that area?
Well, I think if you're in the community large enough that has the university, you probably also got some AA groups or some Al-Anon groups that would be available, and these people are always happy to come and make a presentation. Again, you would probably have a mental health organization. There's generally one member of the staff that got some expertise in this area that might be able to come over to address your students. But I think if you can meet a recovering young person in the university community, you might ask that person whether they would be willing to share their life story to help other people understand the insidiousness of alcoholism.
Counseling.
Counsel on alcoholism. If the community is any size at all, they should have a branch of the counsel on alcoholism there.
I have another one too. Let's say it's a clergy wife. We know, like with a brother in the parish, I'm wondering, let's say it's the wife. Mm-hmm. The pastor's in kind of a difficult situation being the husband, you know, to deal with the problem, even though I'm sure he can help some, but certainly there's going to be some problem there. I was wondering who can he turn to them. Let's say we have someone, a brother's wife in the circuit or something that's having problems with alcohol. What can we do then to help her? Or who should he turn to?
Well, if you suspect the pastor's wife with a problem, you would want to discuss it with him, right?
Sure.
But I think you can find out which of the wives in the community have a fairly good relationship with her, that they might be able to go to her initially as a loving sister. Hey, we're concerned about you. You know, every time we get together, you volunteer to be the barmaid, and you get a little gay and happy, and you always want to stay for one more. You know, we're really concerned about this kind of behavior. Can we be of some help, or do you feel that you might need some help? And be sure you know where you can offer the help. But again, I think it just takes a very honest, loving demonstration of concern. But she may try to go jump in the lake. You don't have a lake around here, do you? Up there, we can tell them to jump in the lake. But at least you planted a seed. Or you may give her some literature you were suggesting a while ago. You may find another woman in the community who is a member of AA and ask whether the lady in the community would mind meeting with someone. You don't have to identify who it is at all at this point. And then you could go to the pastor's wife and say, hey, I know Mary Jones over here. She had a problem with alcohol one time. Maybe you could sit down and talk with her, and she could begin to understand some of your concerns.
You've touched a very sensitive spot there, Tony. In terms of the pastor and his wife, the pastor is the only pastor that she has to turn to, and she finds it impossible because he's most likely part of the problem that has led to alcoholism. And so you have a very sensitive kind of situation. Relates to many other things too. The wife feels a great deal of stress because of expectations from the congregation. She really can't discuss it freely and openly with her husband because he'd be on the side of the congregation exhorting her to fulfill many of these obligations because it'll make him look good. Or reversely, if she doesn't do it, he'll look bad. So it's more or less an ongoing problem in the ministry today that the wife understands that she's part of the ministry, but she's not an assistant pastor, that the relationship and the intimacy of that marriage be fortified, particularly because it is a model setting by scriptural exhortation. And being cognizant of this, both husband and wife really have to work at communication. If that's the case, hopefully this will be caught before it turns into alcoholism. So I'd like to see the preventive aspect stressed somewhat. Ed has given you the possibilities once it's there, what would be available to her. But I see this as a growing problem in the church and perhaps contributing a great deal to the increase of divorces in parsonages today. We must be aware, even before we graduate, and you wives who are present tonight realize what you're getting into and the need for good open communication at all times that really centers around prayer life and your own family devotional lives. Very essential to keep on filling up on the strength of the Holy Spirit.
Ms. Silva had her hand.
Are you asking whether you should or shouldn't? I personally have no struggle with that at all. I give them the option of grape juice or wine. If the individual is on antabuse, as we mentioned a while ago, there's no way I would give them wine. Some of you laugh at that, but I've had several pastors tell me, that's ridiculous. The Lord wouldn't give you anything in the sacrament that's going to be harmful. Well, that kind of rationale is hard for me to accept. Because even that small amount of wine might be enough to kick off that reaction. The other thing, I think there are some who have not had enough sobriety and stability to really have disassociated the feelings, the attitudes with the wine at that time. And they feel very tense, uncomfortable, about receiving the wine, and I think we can relieve some of that tension by offering them the grape juice. At the hospital, I always have wine and grape juice in the tray. And I let them know each time we have the sacrament, the dark colored is the grape juice, the light colored is the wine. So they know in advance, so they take whichever they want. I personally think it's very difficult to prove that it must be wine. That's my own personal opinion.
I'll respond in terms of my own parish practice, where we were dealing with a recovered alcoholic or an alcoholic period. I would make the same offer of grape juice, but I usually, since it's very difficult in the parish setting to identify the grape juice or to even have it ready for one individual coming up to the altar, I usually suggested private communion with their family. This was part of my parish practice. And I think that the New Testament word we of course have all kinds of arguments that it must be wine, or fruit of the vine is really the New Testament concept. And so I would tend to agree with Chaplain Eggert that fruit of the vine can also include grape juice as well as wine. We know that the practice was most likely wine, but I don't think this is a deviation from an important element of the sacrament as such. So I felt free to use grape juice, and I usually identified it with private communion for the family of the alcoholic. I know that sort of identifies them, but it was done quietly after the service, not during the service.
There's one other thing I do. It's my own personal practice. I'm not saying everybody must do it or ought to do it, but I feel comfortable with it. That if I have a patient who, while he's there, requests a sacrament, I have another private little session with that individual and review with that individual again the blessing of the sacrament, to really be sure that they got their head screwed on right, that they're not thinking alcohol at this time, but they're thinking the body and blood of Christ. And I first think we need to emphasize the second part of that blessing. It's not only for the visible reassurance of the forgiveness of sin, but also the strengthening of faith in Almighty God, the third step of the program, see? And they really need this. Emphasis on faith in God, not faith in the alcohol anymore. They've put the faith and the confidence in the alcohol, and that confidence needs to be transferred back to Almighty God. And the sacrament, the means of grace, helps in that process.
Charlie, did you have a practice? Mm-hmm. I would concur with what you said. Thank you. Tom Stowe?
I just have a practical for the distribution. As Dr. Henry mentioned, my bishop on Vickers had a practice. He had an individual cup. Mm-hmm. He left the outer row open, and he handed them all in there. But that way he knew which one was
going to be. It's a little tricky, though, because if they're on antabuse and you make a mistake, you're living with a tragedy.
My classmate's got a question. Well, I think I can't give you a categorical answer. I have some opinions about it. One is that I think a lot of us as pastors have kind of come out of an attitude, almost a culture, where we do a fair amount of drinking, let's face it. At prep school, at SEM, senior college, wherever. Probably here at the seminary as well. In fact, I understand you even have privilege now, you can have booze in your rooms. You know, well, that's a new one, from when I was around here at least. I think that's one thing. So I think you've had the introduction to the use of beverage alcohol, which was kind of accepted. But the ministry is also a pretty tension-oriented profession.
Stress-related.
And, you know, there are a lot of expectations being put on us, some rightfully, but I think we put a lot of expectations on ourselves. I think I was talking about this morning, the messianic complex. I think some of us go out with that, you know, and we need to work through that. We don't have to be all things to all people, you know, we don't have to save everybody. We let him save a few and him save a few. So I think the ability to learn to deal with tension is not something that we as clergy do very well. The other thing, I learned this in my second quarter of CPE. My supervisor asked me one day, who's your father confessor? And I looked at him and said, what are you talking about? He said, every pastor needs a father confessor. And the more I thought about it, and Russell Dixon, his early books, the writings, referred to it as a trusted friend. Every pastor should have a trusted friend. I have followed that religiously since then. It's been a fantastic safety valve. Because there are times when I feel like creeping at a wall, you know, and I lose perspective and I begin to carry my patients home with me. And fortunately, God gave me a good wife, and she spotted immediately just by my attitude. See? I sit at the dinner table in the evening, I'm very quiet. I don't even notice it, but my wife does. And she says, had a tough day, didn't you? I said, what do you mean? Well, you did, didn't you? You had to have a problem you haven't dealt with, something like that? Okay, you're right, Ruth, and I need to deal with it. Maybe I need to get on the phone and call my father confessor. I said, hey, I need a little time with you. But how many of us learn to do that? It's almost like it's an admission of defeatism.
Weakness.
Yeah, that I have to ask somebody else or go to somebody else and pour my heart out to him. Hey, I need to sit down and talk to you. And I think we need to learn to do that.
You still want in?
If I can go back to the earlier, it seems like a lot of the effect comes from the shock treatment and the confrontation of the family. If the parents put the adolescent in, is that enough of a shock that will he remember later? That's the first part. Secondly, is that enough of a prevention to keep the adolescent from going back? Secondly, is there a buildup of confidence or whatever in the program? And thirdly, do you assume that there is something wrong in the family that the pastor should deal with or counsel together with the family with afterwards?
Let's see if I can take these in order. Your first question, okay, was about the parents simply say, hey, Mary, you're going to the hospital, or Johnny. With the adolescents, rarely. We do know that the percentage of rehabilitation with adolescents is extremely low, maybe 12%, the first time around. Second time around, it jumps up pretty good to around 55%. And I'm sure this is going to vary from one locale to another. Unfortunately, in Milwaukee, or Wisconsin in general, we have very, very limited facilities, halfway house type, for adolescents. We have about 82% of our kids come from emotionally disturbed homes, where either the father or the mother or both are also still chemically active, or there's a divorce, or there's a single parent home. To send the kids back into that same kind of environment is not very conducive to sobriety. We know that, but we have nothing to offer. So the kid comes into treatment, many of our adolescents are extended. You know, normally we have a 30-day program, but many of our adolescents are extended a week to 2 weeks. And then we try to get them plugged into our aftercare facility, which is another 16 weeks in the outpatient clinic.
And those that we can keep plugged into the aftercare program, we do pretty good with them, in spite of what their home situation is, because we have a strong enough support system here, which in a sense overrides what's happening at home. But I think the most effective thing in the for the adolescent group is the peer pressure of those who are making it. You know, they really come down hard on the kids who are messing up. If they see a kid coming into a meeting high, oh, they really get all over them. Probably more effective than what the counselors do. Now, I forget, what was your second concern? Okay. Yeah, okay. The last year, and we learned this the hard way, at first when the adolescent was coming in, if the parents have to sign the admission order, they could come in. We have now said you can come in provided you as the parents are willing to become involved in therapy with the child. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we won't admit the child. See? And that's helped our situation somewhat. So it is pouring water down the rat hole the way we're going the first year, you know, because, you know, the kid came in, we never saw the parents. So, and we run into a situation I talked about this morning. How can I confront the youngster about chemicals if I got no information to confront them with? Other than the parents, in some cases, literally dumped them there. But now, parents, you have to sign this commitment. You're going to get involved in treatment with them.
I'm happy to hear this from Chaplain Eggert, because it's been since Virginia Satir and Carl Whitaker and others have pioneered family therapy with their full realization that usually something is wrong, not just with the identified patient, but with the entire family dynamic. And sometimes one must go back to the family of origin of both husband and wife, father and mother in that setting. So the systems approach is really the only sound approach to good therapy in this and many other kinds of mental disorders, compulsivity and obsessions and so forth.
Go ahead, we see the young lady, go ahead. I'm only aware of two studies, and would you believe that both the studies indicated that there's a higher incidence of compulsive drinking in the children who grew up in total absence families over against those where moderation was accepted? Yeah, the most intense one was probably the one that was done in Indiana with all the juniors and seniors in high school. And you know, you southern Indiana with its high population of free Methodism where total absence is sinful, they had a high incidence of alcoholism among the kids in that area. The same was the study was done in California, found the same thing. Yeah.
I'll be running along now.
Okay.
Gotta get back to theological interviews. This has been fascinating, though.
Okay.
We hope they pass you.
Yeah.
Good to
hear. How long do you want to go?
I don't know. 9 o'clock, I should think, should be our limit. Don't you think so? Do we have a consensus about that? Another 10 minutes? I think that would be good.
I don't know
who's
next.
Hasn't.
Go ahead.
Who
I thought three hands. Yeah. Okay.
It's a sort of rapid. What is the reference to both of these? Now, what is sufficient or adequate enough training before I need to perish?
What is what?
Sufficient or adequate training to confront, to deal, to minister to the alcoholic before I get into perish.
I'll let you handle that one. You're in the pastoral care department here.
Now, it's too late to take my course this year, you know, unless you want to stay around the summer.
Is your course adequate enough? If I took your course?
To do what?
To minister to the alcoholic in the full, from the initial assessment all the way full circle.
I wouldn't lay claim to that.
That's not the intent of my course, to make you an alcoholism counselor or therapist. It does have some components of pastoral counseling in it, certainly, but it primarily comes at it from a pastoral care perspective. Because normally my assumption is that we will not get into extended or long-term treatment therapy with the alcoholic person, that we will refer to treatment center or AA, and that we'll be supportive
kind of people. There may be some short-term pastoral counseling there in terms of contract or whatever, but that's not the intent of my course. So I wouldn't know where to tell you to go. I don't even think that maybe going to Rutgers Summer School of Alcohol Studies would do that job for you. It may have to be some quarters of CPE in an alcoholism treatment hospital like Lutheran General, I suspect.
Would you suspect? Yeah, because I don't think you'll ever get to the point where you've got it all, because, you know, I think in any social illness, there's constant change, there's things we learn from year to year, that it's an ongoing process. But I don't think you have to feel that you're the expert. I think a loving heart, a concern for the soul of the individual, is certainly a big step in the right direction. And, you know, there's a few good textbooks that will certainly help you. And I think one of the other things that this is a big help, you ought to start going to some AA meetings. You know, start listening to alcoholics. You know, one of the things that happened to me here in Milwaukee when I was at the LMA, I tried to get an AA group started at Cook Hospital. Because you know, 55% of our tubercular patients at that time also had an alcohol problem. And we treat them for the tuberculosis, and we discharge them, and 2-3 months they'd be back with tuberculosis. They'd broken down again because they got back in their, stuck in their brown bags. And I went to the administrator and suggested an AA meeting. He thought I was off my rocker. So I finally got one of the Jewish doctors to agree with me, and we sold it to the administration. Can you believe we had to sell to the city health commissioner to put an AA group in a state or in a city hospital, which was supported by tax dollars? And the only way they let us do it, would you believe, that I had to personally attend every AA meeting that was conducted there. And if I couldn't be there some night, I had to cancel the meeting. For 4 years, I sat in on every Wednesday evening AA meeting at DePaul Hospital. That's when I got acquainted with AA, with alcohol.
Yeah, Coke Hospital.
Yeah, at Coke Hospital, yeah. You got to rub shoulders with these guys. You got to talk with them. You begin to understand their, you get their lingo, you get their feelings, you get their attitudes, what their behavior has been. If you're going to stay in this business. But I think, you know, I don't think you need all that at Parish Pride, but I think you ought to attend some AA meetings. Get acquainted with the AA people in your community. They can be a fantastic resource to you.
I just wanted to take the opportunity to respond to Dr. Dowd's question about the high number of supporters of alcoholism. Everything has been said about chemical dependence. I think part of the problem, too, is that Satan spends a great deal of time trying to either discredit or ruin entirely the ministry of the public servants that we're talking. And with all the talk of St. Paul on spiritual warfare, I mean, something we need to keep in mind in regards to alcoholism, especially for public clergy.
If you were the pastor, I thought I would be invited to a party or something. Party, somebody wants to offer you a drink, and you know that there are among these people
I'm not sure I got the first part of your question. Did you say the person who offered me a drink was someone I suspected to be alcoholic? What was that? I can't give you a yes or no on that. I think depending on what the situation is, there are in some situations I would feel at ease to join them in a beverage, and there are other situations where I feel I may be causing some offense. It would be not appropriate. It would not be discreet, and I choose not to. I don't think, for example, the hospital has a get-together Christmas or picnic or something like that, and we don't say that the non-alcoholics or members of the families are not permitted to have a beer, but I choose not to drink at any hospital functions. Nobody in the, policy and procedure manual doesn't say that I can't, but I don't think it would be good discretion for me to drink if some of our patients were around. In my own private home, I may invite Charlie over, and I said, Charlie, would you care for a beer? And I would not feel uncomfortable about that at all. I was out with some friends of mine this evening for dinner, and they had some port wine, and I had a glass of wine. I don't feel uncomfortable about that at all. But there are some situations, weddings, for example, of patients at the hospital. I choose not to drink at those weddings.
Dan,
oh,
Dan,
one
Dan,
more?
Dan,
okay.
I'm glad I guess.
Oh,
Dan,
all right. Go ahead. I personally don't. I'm not saying you shouldn't, you could, you mustn't. I personally choose not to.
What are the reasons for that?
I don't feel that I should expect any kind of rational commitment from the individual while he's under the influence of a mood-altering drug. What he tells me, what he promises me at that time, maybe something that he doesn't even recall the next day. But if I put a lot of stock in it, I say, well, this is what you promised me last night, he may say, no, I didn't, and he probably really didn't. Any more than I would ask you, if you were under the influence of ether, to make a statement. See? I'll wait till he's sobered up.
It's even less productive if he's in an alcoholic blackout, and that's happened in the pastoral care. Okay.
There's a group of physicians in Germany who are of the opinion that it is. I'm not aware of any recognized pharmacologist in America that says it is. It sometimes appears that way, but I think what it is more than hereditary is the influence of an environmental factor. Or a tension factor. You see sometimes in one family, two or three children with an alcohol problem. We know, for example, that 52% of alcoholics have an alcoholic parent. Well, I don't think it's a genetic thing, but if you've grown up in a household where a parent is actively chemically dependent, you can bet your last dollar that there's some real emotion, some real tension in that household. And growing up in that tension may lead to chemical dependence. I personally don't think it's a genetic thing or hereditary thing. And so I'm not, Charlie, maybe you know, are you aware of anyone in America that refers to it as hereditary?
People talk that way, but I don't know that they really have any studies to support it, to talk that way.
Did the lady, did you have a comment, Matt?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Right. Oh, you
yeah.
did. Okay.
All right, one more.
Can you what?
The first one deals with...
You got 30 seconds.
About families.
About what?
Alcoholics.
Families.
In a family.
Oh.
We, you know, I realize there's a lot of things that directly happen to that, the children, the family, and the wife. Are there some things that symptoms of a family situation with developing alcoholic, which are not directly the result of a positive eating and eating? Something, for example, like perhaps delinquency of the children, or apathetic apathy towards school, or something like that. Are those kind of things? Do those kind of things come up in families which have alcoholic parents? Maybe not directly related to
I don't know what I could say, you know, it's a direct causal relationship. You just see so many sociological problems with the kids who grew up in a household where either dad or mom have a chemical problem. Truancy, kids running away. Poor communication in general. You know, the kids talk about the communication gap, and there's really one there where either the father or mother is dependent on the chemical, because they're not interested in the kids. They're concerned about, where am I going to get my next drink? I don't know if that's directly related. I'm not sure I understood your question, but I don't know of anything you can say, because there's a father or mother chemical dependent, therefore the kids will manifest these problems. I don't think there's anything that categorical. Are you aware of anything? There's just a whole panorama of sociological problems that develop, and I'm not sure that there's one that's more pronounced than another.
Was that it, or did you have a follow-up to that?
Oh, it's not long enough. As far as
captive.
Rehabilitation.